It has been a difficult 3 years for the small northern nation of Iceland. In fact, as the country's president put it recently, if you were to try to create the perfect laboratory experiment to test the resilience of a nation, you could hardly do better than what Iceland has experienced. The country was the first to be hit by the global financial upheaval. The failure of its banks led to a complete economic collapse. 1 year later, a volcano with an almost unpronounceable name erupted, covering the country in ash. Then, 6 months later, came a second massive eruption. As President Olafur Grimson put it, it was a sobering experience, and that is an understatement. So it is no small achievement that 3 years after it all began, Iceland appears to be emerging from the worst of the crisis. Unemployment is down to levels that many other European nations would envy. Investment is returning, and the economy is projected to grow by as much as 3% this year. What makes this all the more remarkable is the way Iceland has done it. Instead of following the standard formula of severe austerity and debt repayment, Iceland did pretty much the opposite. Olafur Grimson is the president of Iceland. This morning he's in a studio in Reykjavik. Mr. President, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you on our program. You have said that the collapse, the financial collapse in your country threatened your entire democratic and social system. How so?
It was an extraordinary experience to witness how the collapse of the banks, their financial crisis, seemed to be in the process of breaking up the very strong social cohesion which has characterized Iceland for centuries. In our country, this led to continuous protests in the streets, even at the height of winter, riots in front of the parliament and the prime minister's office. And from one day to another, as we came into January of 2009, what I feared every morning when I woke up was not that we wouldn't be able to deal with the economic consequences, but whether what was happening to our political and social and democratic system would completely split apart and we wouldn't be able to put it together again.
How far away from the collapse of that social cohesion you talk about do you think the country actually was?
Well, it's very difficult to say. We had the moment in the middle of the night in January where there was a big crowd outside the prime minister's office demonstrating, and the police was guarding the prime minister's office with shields and helmets, and the crowd started throwing rocks at the police officers and the policemen. And then it seemed that perhaps the prime minister's office would be invaded. But then all of a sudden, a small group came out of the crowd of demonstrators and put themselves in front of the police force. So the stones that were being thrown would hit fellow protesters. And many of us believe that if these individuals, 15, 20 of them or so, had not at that moment decided that enough was enough, nobody could have predicted what would have happened during that night.
And nothing like this has ever happened in Iceland before.
No, never, ever. So, as I have said to many, both financial leaders and political leaders in other countries, what all of this demonstrated is that banks, financial institutions, those who operate in the financial markets, both nationally and globally, they carry an enormous political and democratic and social responsibility because their actions on their own can break down our democratic and political system. So the theory, which was very popular from the 1980s onwards, so that somehow the market was supreme, and if you allowed the market to go ahead full force, the rest of society and our political system would somehow take care of itself. What we witnessed in Iceland, that this was turned on its head, that the failure in the market threatened the breakdown of our entire political and democratic system. And that is a very important lesson for those who have educated the superiority of the market forces without taking into consideration the consequences that we are now witnessing. But fortunately for us in Iceland, we were wise enough somehow early on, perhaps due to these events that I have just described, to realize that this challenge, this crisis, was not just an economic crisis. It was also a fundamental political and social and democratic challenge.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons why many European countries and perhaps even the United States and Britain are still facing these enormous financial and economic challenges that we are now seeing every day, every week, every month, is that it's only very recently that the leaders of Europe and the United States have solely faced, have squarely faced it, that this is also a profound political and democratic challenge.
Mr. President, let's talk about the remedies that Iceland undertook. The economic orthodoxy of the day says that the standard prescription for economies in trouble facing the challenges that you did was severe austerity, slashing government spending, bailouts if necessary of financial institutions. How much of that did Iceland in fact do, or did you reject all of that?
I think it is illustrative to perhaps divide the Icelandic response or the Icelandic way into three different dimensions. The first was what I have just described, that we defined the challenge not just as an economic challenge, but also as a profound political and social and democratic challenge. So we instigated various measures to deal with this political challenge. We established a commission to examine the failure of the banks, the corporations, and political institutions in our country. We appointed a special prosecutor's office, which became the largest judicial entity in our country. We even set in motion examination of our constitution, as well as various other legislative reforms that were enacted following the financial collapse. So the first dimension is to treat this as a profound challenge to society and the political system. The second dimension is that in various financial and economic measures, we went, as you mentioned, against the prevailing orthodoxies. We, for example, did not pump public money into the banks. These were private banks, so we allowed them to fail. Those who had lent money to these banks had to take the responsibilities of having operated in the free market. We let our currency, the krona, be devalued strongly. We instigated budgetary measures that tried to shield those who are the poorest or faced biggest difficulties because of their social status. And we enacted many other measures that were contrary to the traditional recommendations by experts or international institutions. And it was very interesting that at a recent farewell conference that was held in Reykjavik, because the IMF program is over, IMF has now left Iceland because of the success of our recovery, the IMF leadership, which participated in this conference, acknowledged that dealing with Iceland had been a very interesting and fundamental learning process for the IMF.
But, Mr. President, the IMF at the time warned Iceland that you would never again be able to borrow if you didn't bail out the banks. And politicians in Europe said the same thing. The rating agencies demanded that the government honor the debts of the banks.
Well, all of this is true. With respect to the rating agencies, I have to tell you that I still think they have a lot to answer for, because when we look back at why we didn't take measures in 2006 and 2007 or early 2008, when some experts were warning us about the banking system, the rating agencies, all of them, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch, all gave the Icelandic banks a clean bill of health, even an excellent certificate. So the fundamental question with respect to the rating agencies is that if they were so wrong in the years leading up to the banking crisis, why are they suddenly right now? But you are right. We did not follow these traditional measures that are, in fact, still these very days being pushed in various European countries. And that came out very squarely in what I call the third dimension of the Icelandic response. That in this very difficult dispute with Britain and the Netherlands, where they demanded that the people of Iceland should be formally responsible for the debt of a private Icelandic bank that operated in Britain and the Netherlands, I decided, following a strong national demand, to put that to a referendum, to let the democratic will of the people be superior to the financial interest of the market. And when I took that decision in the beginning of 2010, it went against not only the majority in my own parliament and what the government had decided, but every government in Europe was telling me that that was wrong. That the financial market, the financial markets, should be supreme in confrontation with the democratic will of the people. But I decided to go the other way. There were a lot of people who predicted that that would be the downfall of Iceland. We would be isolated in the world. We will become the Cuba of the North. But the fact of the matter is, the people of Iceland twice were able to exercise their democratic will, and now Iceland is coming out of this crisis and establishing recovery earlier and more effectively than other European countries.
There are two elements about that. First of all, there was a bill passed. You refused to sign it, didn't you? And you decided to go to the people in a referendum.
Yes.
Even though Brown in the UK threatened to freeze Iceland's assets in that country. He's not a very popular man, I take it, if he ever shows up in Reykjavik.
Well, Gordon Brown, God bless his political memory, will be long remembered in Iceland after he has been forgotten in Britain, because we have a long historical memory. We still remember those Vikings who traveled to what's now Canada a thousand years ago. But you're right. I mean, they exercised extraordinary measures against Iceland. They even evoked the terrorist legislation against Iceland, put Iceland on the list with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, even if we were a founding member of NATO, paid out of the banks without asking us, and then decided to send the bill to Iceland. And if we didn't obey, they tried to use their position within the IMF board to block the IMF program for Iceland. It was an extraordinary display throughout 2009 of using sheer force against our country.